This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Please take care while listening and email us at svri@svri.org for resources.
Welcome to another episode of the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I'm Aisha Margot.
And I am Elizabeth Dartnell. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we're discussing the role of technology in facilitating gender-based violence. What impact is the internet having on the safety and well-being of women, both online and offline?
Our guest today is Maya Indira Ganesh, a technology and digital cultures researcher, writer, and educator. A feminist activist and researcher, Maya now co-leads a master's program on AI, ethics, and society at the University of Cambridge, and is also a senior research fellow at the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence.
Whether it's trolling, the sharing of intimate images, or the use of hate speech and threats, violence that happens online rarely stays there. Online violence has many real-world implications, from psychological effects to physical harms. Maya begins by exploring this connection between online and offline violence.
I think the place that we must start is actually not just between online and offline, but kind of we have to start with the body and how we understand the place of the body in context of the digital. Now, when we're thinking about violence, one of the places we often go to quite early, quite soon, is the law, because we think about this one offline place of accountability for violence. Formal accountability is the law. And of course, there's all kinds of informal accountability and justice that I think is related to dealing with violence, but the law kind of structures society and our thinking so much about the place of the body. So in this legal understanding, the body is material, but it's also very atomized. You know, the self is also very coherent and atomized within just, you know, the form of your body. But what the digital does is that it offers this seduction of the body as being not necessarily coherent and material, but not material, of being not atomized, of being not whole, and of being distributed. And I think part of what made the internet exciting was that you could entertain the notion of escaping your body for a bit. But I think that also many of us will understand our identities, if not our bodies, we understand our identities as also similarly very distributed. I think this was something that was quite compelling about the internet, and cyber feminists have been talking about this for a long time. And for most people, however, particularly women, you cannot really escape your body, because you're not just disembodied when you're online. You know, you're also a person who is holding a mobile phone. That mobile phone is in a certain cultural and social situation. And it seems almost banal to have to say these things because, you know, it's all very obvious. But I think we forget this when we start talking in terms of, you know, the digital body and the digital experience, because we just assume that we are just always online all the time and that has no sort of grounding elsewhere. But I think that this person, this identity that's online and speaking, having a voice that's not connected to a body, is a really important kind of baseline way to start thinking about online and offline violence.
So what does this understanding of the body mean for the people experiencing violence online?
I think this fragmentation and cohesion kind of sets up affordances for how violence happens. Let's think of some examples. And, you know, this is all based on work that feminist technologists, including groups like APC, my own work at Tactical Tech, and, you know, the networks of people in the sort of gender and technology space have been doing for about 15 years now. So if you think about attacks on an offline person because of their online activities, let's say, that's a very obvious way in which we can see this connection between online and offline violence. So there was a fantastic study done in Pakistan, actually, maybe about 6-7 years ago, about how a woman who was on Facebook and part of a community on Facebook had pictures posted on that group in which she was not wearing hijab because she was with a safe space of known people, other women. Now, because of the settings associated with those photographs and who could see it, a male cousin spotted a picture of this woman online wearing hijab offline and now reported this to the family. And so you have, what you have here is, in the offline space, this woman was in a familiar, known community in which she could remove her head, her coverings. But that picture was then online. So you see the lateral surveillance by the cousin and the sort of telling on her. And then, you know, she got into trouble with her family and was not allowed to go onto the internet. And her phone was confiscated. And then, you know, there was more surveillance that happened offline. So I love this example because it really brings to light sort of the sort of complexities of what it means to inhabit these multiple spaces and how violence then, you know, happens.
We know that technology-facilitated gender-based violence covers a spectrum of behaviors, including stalking, bullying, and hate speech. Maya explores how some of these behaviors play out and why it can be difficult to measure and gather data for research.
There's no one method. You know, I think there was a report by APC that listed sort of like 13 different kinds of violence that happen. And, you know, in addition to things like bullying, like stalking or doxing, you know, where sometimes it's the physical body is not being attacked, but the digital body and what you are in terms of the data you represent, the data about you, how that becomes the source and site of violation. So it can sometimes be very hard for us to, even for ourselves as people who might experience those things, or to live in fear of things about you being made public. So doxing is the release of personal information online. People, because we often don't have very strong digital habits, we put a lot of information about ourselves online. I think this has changed. I think people now are much more aware of what information goes out about them online. I mean, I had an experience once many, many years ago of wishing my colleague happy birthday on Twitter. And she got very, very upset with me. And she said, don't ever wish me happy birthday again online, because that's putting information about my birth date online. And we know that that forms part of a picture of who we are online. So you maybe, you know, your personal body has not been affected in any way, but you can be very anxious knowing that your address, for instance, could be available online. There are examples where that has been used by abusive men to stalk their wives and their families. The kind of malware that you would find, so spyware, tracking software that you would find used in, you know, non-intimate contexts, almost militaristic and surveillance contexts deployed by companies and states, make their way into, you know, everyday consumers. So you have well-documented cases of domestic abuse and violence where people are tracked by their partners. I know somebody who wasn't on the internet for 13 years because of somebody who was stalking her. And even though it was known who the stalker was, she just wasn't online. And it somehow blew my mind to think that all she did was she would go, it almost like she ran into the internet, checked her email and ran out again, you know, and never tried to leave any traces of herself. And that's a very different kind of experience, because we don't think about what we do with our devices, you know, and when you have to start thinking about every single step. So it, when you then have to research that kind of experience, actually, I think we have to go back to like the basics of any kind of sexual violence research that feminists researchers have been doing prior to the internet. So a great deal of sensitivity in knowing that sometimes we may not have the language, that people who've experienced violence may not have the language to actually talk about the experiences they've had, because our language is very rooted in ideas about what happens when the physical body gets affected. So I think there's special kinds of sensitivity. And because the internet, the digital is such a big part of our lives now, we might start using different kinds of language to relate to how we communicate online. So I think that's one issue. And the other in research is that, you know, it's kind of ironic that the thing that the internet does really well is record stuff. It is a great recording machine. And we are constantly giving out traces and information about ourselves. But sometimes that information does not always belong to us. We cannot always see it. We cannot always measure it. So, for instance, images of yourself that you shared with a partner, and then that partner has put online or shared with other people, a non-consensual sharing of intimate images that you may have given with consent, in some cases, little less consent. Once that information goes onto the internet and is held somewhere, it doesn't actually belong to you. It belongs to whoever controls that platform. So to be able to take those images down, or to be able to access those images if you want to study them or get metadata, get information about the data, you have to then negotiate with a platform. And people who have experienced this kind of violation in terms of non-consensual image sharing have this problem, you know, being able to access the images and to have them taken down. So as researchers as well, you have to be aware of things like, you know, what data policies govern sharing of information. And this is different in different parts of the world. I mean, one good thing is when it comes to things like non-consensual sharing of images, there's been a lot of movement in the law to make it possible for prosecution, make it, you know, to really think from the victim's perspective. But I think researchers need to be aware that not all data is accessible, not all data is legible, and that you may have to have all kinds of interesting new ways of managing your data, of collecting it, of securing it, of being in touch with victims about what they want to, how they want to have their data talked about, because there's a big, you know, sort of discussion about anonymization of personal information now, you know, in the context of data privacy generally. If we're doing research on sexual violence or technology-enabled, facilitated gender-based violence, then we'd really have to think about things like, what are the potential privacy violations for people who've experienced that when you want to, let's say, publish information about violence? How do you anonymize that? Because as a researcher, you need to show your evidence. You need to put it all out there. And so I think we need to be talking with people who we work with, people who've experienced violence, to say, if we had to research this, what would it look like? Get them to also understand what kinds of information about them are in that data that we want to study. And that's why I think there's great opportunities for more sort of participatory action research in this with people who've experienced that kind of violence. Really good old-fashioned feminist research, I would say. Maybe I give the example of a really interesting study done by a scholar at Cornell University called Nathan, where they wanted to see what happens when you report violence to Twitter. And I think it was an important and interesting study of how does that complaint move up the chain and how does it get addressed. And so reading about how that study was conducted, how it involved, you know, things that we don't often think of in sexual violence research and negotiating with companies.
To avoid the internet for 13 years because of horrific experiences online, it really is chilling to hear these stories. Surely the tech platforms must be doing something to address these online harms?
Well, companies like Twitter and Facebook do have dedicated teams working to reduce online harms, yet these spaces still aren't safe places for women. So what's going wrong? Maya explains what social media companies are and are not protecting us against.
The role of social media companies has changed, where initially they were like, hey, anyone can come and say what they want. And it's, you know, this Californian ideology of speech and freedom and all of that. Then as more people started getting online and online harassment became an issue, social media companies did start to take things seriously. They instituted trust and safety officers. They started to get, you know, serious about these things, because I think there was a big push, especially things like cyberbullying, harassment. I mean, the looking at images, child pornography, and tracking of child porn and terrorism, these have been like two of the most important drivers of the internet security field in any case. But it's when people, especially feminists, want to sit on this complex, difficult line of saying, you know, I want my privacy and I want my anonymity, and I also want to use this technology for sex, for relationships, for self-expression. This complexity, this nuance is something that is not possible within these computational systems, legal systems. So I think social media companies have tried to balance that, thanks only to the advocates, the feminist and tech policy advocates who've tried to negotiate with them. And they still haven't done well. I mean, while you want to sort of protect certain kinds of speech and women and children, there are others who are also not being included in that. So shutting down places like Tumblr has affected, I think, queer communities, sex work communities. I mean, I think sex work organizing in many parts of Europe and North America has been really strong on these issues and showing how they continue to be surveilled and vilified and discriminated, whereas there might be moves towards more security and privacy for certain kinds of more, familiar, legible kinds of women, children, marginalized communities. So I think that all of that has been happening while the fact that it is very profitable to not actually address violence, because the minute you start doing that, then you have to start booting people off. You need to start being very clear about how you enforce your community guidelines and things like that. And like, why would you do that? Because, you know, this is where social media companies are like, listen, we don't do society. We don't deal with social stuff. At the same time, they want to think that they're having like a lot of social influence in reshaping society, and they do. So you can't kind of have it both ways. And I think now what happened with the Trump election and Cambridge Analytica really started drawing these lines around what was considered central and this level at which politics happens. So the stuff that happens to women, to children, to queer people, to marginalized communities, this is not politics. What happens at the level of, you know, the nation state, this is considered sort of politics. So the focus is there on misinformation and hate speech and terrorism and, you know, all of that. So, and all very, very significant issues. But I think that the funding and the commitment towards things like online harassment has fallen off, and it's just become normalized. It's now on internet users themselves to protect themselves. And I think now in the context of Facebook and, I mean, Elon Musk taking over Twitter and things like this, I mean, it's gone. It's over. You know, I think that there's a certain internet era which is over. And I think questions like online harassment and how we deal with them need to be rethought, as maybe this is a moment when we see an emergence of new kinds of relationships with the digital, new kinds of platforms that maybe, you know, hopefully learn from, you know, the work that's gone before. So I think we're at the start of a different kind of evolution, but what this means, especially in the global south, is something else. You know, just because people in the largest markets in Europe or North America are, you know, fed up or want something different, doesn't mean that it automatically rolls out in the same way everywhere in the world, you know? So I think we're kind of inhabiting multiple internets at the same time under very different social, political, and cultural conditions and contexts.
It is critical that we address the negative impacts of online harassment that are stopping people from engaging online, because we live in a digital world and we cannot let women lose their voice, their ability to speak up.
So, amid these many different internets we're inhabiting and lackluster efforts from social media companies, how then can we find safe spaces online for women? Is it even possible?
A book that I would recommend to all of your listeners called Silicon Values by Gillian York. It's a really great book that engages with this question really well of taking this, you know, perspective of the last 10, 15 years of the internet, this promise of everybody being able to have a voice and speak online. Basically, Gillian is arguing that this hasn't really happened for people who are not imagined to be the most powerful and dominant in society. And a lot of the values that determine what we understand as speech is, you know, determined mostly by US law, which is where a lot of these companies come from. But there's been significant pushback in different parts of the world with their own sort of histories of regulating speech. And I think that's what's been really interesting about the internet, and sort of speaks to the hubris of the digital, particularly social media platforms, I think, that have thought of themselves as like, these are platforms to kind of enable speech. But there are some kinds of speech, particularly from, let's say, I mean, feminists have definitely recorded this and talked about this. So very famous case of things like You have the poet, you know, Rupi Kaur, who posts a picture of herself on Instagram about her period. And it's a very compelling photograph. And it's actually like kind of a regular photograph to anybody who has periods, you know. It's a picture of a woman in bed, not facing the camera, but her back is facing the camera. And all you can see is she's wearing sweatpants and there's a blood stain on her track pants. And it's just like such a regular kind of experience. But this was part of her, you know, discovery and exploration of being a young woman and her body and whatever, and posting this on Instagram. Now, this is seen to sort of go against Instagram's policies of speech. And of course, there's been so many campaigns around this. There's the very famous one around, you know, free the nipple. I think this was a very Western, Northern campaign where it was very important for women to be like, you know, being able to show these things. And I think breastfeeding context was one of them in which, you know, you have automated systems or human systems that flag content that's considered to be violating certain guidelines. So there's been a lot of, I think, feminist campaigns over the years of saying that, okay, this is just dumb. This is, you know, we need to be able to say these things online and to show these things online. What's interesting is in the context of automated decision-making, when you have algorithmic technologies that are flagging content, you still have the same kinds of problems because those systems don't actually read context. And they might have gotten a lot better by now, but you still have large teams and social media companies who have to constantly keep, you know, identifying this boundary between what is in the law, what is happening on the ground, what are community standards and guidelines. It's one of those areas where you still have people in social media companies, but you also have people working on the internet, kind of cleaning the internet, so to speak, of imagery that's considered to be violent or distressing, and there's a lot of it online. So going back to this question of, you know, women's speech online and kind of feminist voices and speech online, I think what's also important to recognize is that there are people who cannot speak online because of their physical, political situation and context. And this is really about, like, you know, women journalists who are challenging, for instance, the Indian regime. So you have activists like Sheila Rashid, or you have journalists like Rana Ayub, who, you know, like the friend I mentioned earlier, I mean, like, their relationship with social media is fraught, with the internet is fraught, to the extent where they have to fear for their physical safety. So on the one hand, you have, you know, automated recognition of speech, you know, things that are flagged as being inappropriate. You have human flagging of these things, community guidelines, but you also have a very real situation of women journalists being attacked in some of the most heinous kinds of ways. So I think, I mean, my feeling is that the internet has not been great and good for women generally. And it actually, I say that with no glee. I mean, it's actually quite chilling to say that we have had 10 years, 15 years of research on this topic. And no, it's not getting better. I think that younger generations are navigating very similar kinds of issues. We don't have enough literacy about this also, I think.
And finally, how optimistic is Maya that the field will find a shared understanding of what works to tackle tech-facilitated gender-based violence? Will the internet eventually become a democratic space for everybody to use safely?
I'm generally not positive about the potential of the internet, but that's only if I imagine that it is the internet, it is the digital, it is social media companies that will award us our speech. I think as much as there has been sort of violence and abuse and restrictions and discrimination online, I think the thing that gives me hope and optimism is the work that all of us do in maintaining community and space to kind of keep responding and articulating and saying, no, these boundaries are not acceptable. These lines are not acceptable. So I'm reminded of a young woman I interviewed in 2009. And it was the first study that Manjima Bhattacharya and I did for APC on violence against women online. There was a young woman that we interviewed in a coffee shop in Bombay. And she said something that I've never forgotten. She said, "The internet is a place of dangers, but it is not a dangerous place. And I asked her to make the distinction for me between those two things. And she said, yeah, there are terrible things that happen on the internet, but you have to learn how to navigate them because it is a medium that we live in. And I think she was trying to separate out what happens on the internet from characterizing it as a dangerous place. It certainly has problems, especially when we try to democratize. We say that everybody has to be online. I think that's a challenge. So I think the work that feminist communities have been doing to actually be intentional about the space we want to have, because we are never the intended recipients. We were never intended to be the people who would enjoy these spaces. They were never made for us. So to actually be part of these spaces and to enjoy being on these spaces and doing it on our own terms, I think that's actually where the fun and the joy and the solidarity and the community comes from and has come from. And so I think that's what keeps me optimistic.
A big thank you to Maya Indira Ganesh for joining us on the podcast. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margo. You've been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision, visit www.svri.org.
To free the world of violence against women and violence against children, we need to connect, we must learn, and we must share. So please subscribe, like, and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this episode far and wide.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.